Hello, Serge. How are you?
Hello, Steve. I'm in good shape today. I'm
Excellent.
excited about our day today.
Yeah, we have our first guest today on Fierce Grace.
Yeah, and he's a hell of a guy.
Yeah,
You
he's
know,
a good friend of both of ours.
a good friend, and we work with him a little bit, and he's a wonderful man.
He's written a wide variety of books on different spiritual subjects. Very, very interesting guy.
Yeah, he's like you, Steve. And you're going to say a little bit about why we call our podcast Fierce Grace.
Yeah, Fierce Grace, to me, it has a number of meanings, but I think the meaning which really stands out for me is Fierce Grace is the passion that arises in spiritual development or spiritual awakening. The passion to heal the world, to make the world a better place, to relieve people's suffering, to bring goodness into the world. And to me, it's very significant that a lot of the great mystics in human history, they weren't just hermits who lived in the forest away from the human world. They were people who were very engaged in society. A good example is Florence Nightingale. A lot of people don't know that she was a very spiritually awakened person, a kind of mystic. And she had this amazing energy. They called it Nightingale power because she had so much passion to relieve human suffering. And she basically invented the profession of nursing, and she brought in so many social reforms and health reforms. And that all stemmed from her spirituality, from her mysticism. So to me, that's what Fierce Grace is, and that's what naturally arises when we undergo spiritual development.
And the fierceness, Steve, if you agree here, that the fierceness is that our world is in a challenging place at this moment. It's fierce. There's a lot of fierce things happening. And instead of being overwhelmed by the fierceness and saying, oh dear, I can't do anything, we're using it as a trigger, as a catalyst to help wake us up and move forward. So the fierceness of our world is not the enemy, it's the ally. Right,
That's right.
Steve, would you agree?
I agree completely, Serge. We need to have fierce hope and fierce optimism to resist the darkness and the discord and the suffering in the world. We know the fire, the passion, the spiritual energy that lies inside us has to glow brightly and bring healing into the world.
So we're going to be
Shall we speak to
seeing
Philip
a
now?
fantastic man.
Yeah, let's bring in Philip. Hello, Philip.
Hello.
Hello, my
Hi.
dear
Hi, Philip.
Philip. Hello. We're
Lovely to see you.
so happy to have you on our podcast, my dear Philip. And I'm just going to say a little bit about you so you can find out about yourself,
That
Philip.
would be great help to me, certainly. Yes.
Is that you're going to discover that you're a remarkable man, and we think you a prototype human being that I believe is being developed. But most of all, Steve, Philip, you have a brilliant mind, and you're able to synthesize all sorts of incredibly difficult things. But the most important thing of your spirituality is you have a kind heart. You're a loyal friend, you're gracious, and you're a wonderful father, and you take incredible care of your children, and I know that. And that is what I call what being spiritual is about. Okay, you've written 20 books, fantastic and wonderful, 10 on your druidry, but you're also a good human being. I would call you, Philip, as a very, very grounded and practical mystic. And you're a teacher, and you're a psychologist, and you're a psychotherapist, and you've spent your life exploring the interfaces between psychology and spirituality. And on the way, you just happened to found a Montessori school. And for 30 years, you were head of the Order of Bards and Druids. and you built up Druidry to become a well-known international organization. And so you're an incredible organizer. You're a doer. You're not just a beer. And you're a synthesizer. You're able to integrate many different areas of knowledge. You've just created a new kind of meditation, which you've tried out on me, Philip, and I have to say very successfully. Mm-hmm. I'm honored to have been your guinea pig. And essentially, what you do that is so important is that you're saying what needs to be said, that the healing path needs to embrace many different fields. It's not just about being spiritual. It's not just about doing psychotherapy. It's not just about nature traditions or sort of looking at the wisdom traditions, but it's all of them together. And also, I love the fact that you bring in neuroscience. So, Philip, you're someone who's right on the leading edge. You're leading the way forward for a lot of us. And I had lunch with Philip the other day, and towards the end of lunch, you said to me, "Oh, Serge, please excuse me. I talk so much." And I said to you, "My dear Philip, no apologies. Just go on talking, as I don't know anyone else whose every word is so very, very interesting. And I am very silent to be in your presence and learn from you." So, my dear friends, we are going to have an interesting hour, and we welcome you, Philip. Ho!
Well, thank you so much. What a tremendous introduction. Very kind of you, very kind of you. I'm not sure about being a prototype. I'm not even sure what that means exactly, but everything else, absolutely fabulous. Thank you.
So I was wondering, Philip, how did all this begin? You know, when did you become immersed in psychology and spirituality? Were there any formative influences?
Yeah, there were definitely formative influences. My dad was interested in a lot of stuff, and he ran a magazine from home. He worked at home and ran a history magazine that also had a section on the future, looking at the future as well. So always interesting people turning up at the house. And a lot of people involved in spirituality were friends of his. Christmas Humphreys, the president of the party in London, and so on. And so the house was always full of sort of books and magazines and things. He wasn't in the slightest bit interested in spirituality or religion. He was kind of quite a strong agnostic. He very didn't like organized religion at all. But so the influences there, and he was very interested in psychoanalysis. So we had friends who were psychoanalysts. He had a lot of books on psychoanalysis around. So from a very early age, and then he worked for a while for the old Chief Druid in London. So I met when I was 11, you know, so from this early age, there were these influences around me. So that really helped, I think.
Oh, wow.
So you got into Druidry when you were very young.
When I was very, well, it was also the time, I think we have to think of the sort of the zeitgeist and the cultural, the sort of milieu you're in. So we're talking about the 1960s, you know, and that was an incredible era. I mean, Steve, you've been writing about the Beatles and, Serge, you remember those times.
Absolutely.
So it was a very exciting time to be alive. And I went to school in the middle of London. You know, I went to Westminster School, which is bang in the middle of London by Westminster Abbey. We were going into Westminster Abbey every morning. And I used to love that because it's such an uplifting place to start your morning. Mm-hmm. And of course, that whole era with both flower power, the hippies, the gurus coming in, you know, a bit later, there was a very intense time. So I was kind of immersed in that and benefiting from that, I think.
How do you see these times are different from those times in the 60s? Because we were both sort of hippies at that time in the 60s. Hmm. Well, at least I suppose I was, and I'm sure that you were, Philip.
Yeah.
You know, because we both hold sort of legacies of those of those sort of hairstyles. You know, we don't believe in sort of having our heads shaved. Yeah. Do you feel that we've moved on a lot from the 60s, which didn't seem to really acknowledge the shadow? It was a wonderful new age is dawning that, you know, this is the age of Aquarius and we'll all have love and peace and wonderfulness.
Exactly. Well, I think what happened is, you know, that we've been through the generation that's been through the 60s has then been through, you know, the 70s. It's rather interesting looking at them almost in decades, you know, simplistic, but, you know, roughly you've got the 60s, which was very kind of at some level a sort of innocent time, full of hope. You know, are we going to San Francisco? I always wanted to go to San Francisco and wear flowers in my hair.
I did go and I did wear flowers in my hair.
And it's only sort of now when we look back on documentaries that we find that there was a whole shadow of you know, addiction and problems in Haight-Ashbury and so on. You know, that it wasn't all sweetness and light. But from where I was sitting, it seemed to be all sweetness and light. And there was a time of tremendous liberation. And then you moved into the 70s. The gurus started coming around the 70s. Mm-hmm. I think, didn't the Beatles split up in 69, wasn't it, Steve?
Yeah, 69 or 70.
69, 70, you know, and then, so that era then shifted into the gurus arriving. And I see it almost as like a sort of surf. We sort of surfed that wave and there was an undertow. And the undertow, we probably all had friends who got caught in the undertow, which was basically, you know, getting hooked on drugs or being damaged psychologically, you know, their lives going wrong in some way. So we had friends who got caught in the undertow. But if you carried on, you know, I stopped doing that sort of smoking pot and stuff like that towards the end of the 60s and moved into, you know, studying spiritual stuff and wanting to have those experiences. The sort of main, you know, Ram Dass, I think it was, who said, you know, when you've got the message, hang up the phone. So having got the message about the expanded states of consciousness, I kind of hung up that phone and tried to sort of make calls myself without the aid of drugs. Yeah,
there's an interesting story about George Harrison. He went to Haight-Ashbury in 1968. And he expected it would be a kind of hippie utopia, but he said it was more like the Bowery. It was just full of young kids stoned on drugs and, you know, everybody's really poor and hungry and it was really chaotic and full of crime. And he actually gave up drugs at that point. He thought, this is not where it's at, you know. And he got into meditation at that point.
Well, there you go, you see, yeah. And I suspect, I mean, I've talked to other people. I had an experience I never shared with anybody because it felt very private and, you know, I didn't want to share it. But I have started to talk about it and other people have had the same experiences, which was basically the last LSD trip I took. I was sort of taken out of my body into a sort of vast landscape. And these spiritual beings, these huge spiritual beings, said, okay, that's enough. You've seen you've experienced the reality of these other worlds. You know they exist. Now, you know, don't do this again. Come back under your own steam, not artificially, but under your own steam.
Oh, wow.
And so I stopped. And I was very lucky to have met somebody in Ireland who had developed a meditation method that was very powerful. And so I was able to, you know, progress in that way. But you had, in answer to the wider question that you asked, Serge, you know, what happened in the 70s, you had the guru. But then towards the end of the 70s, I don't know if you remember, but they all started kind of getting busted for tax fraud. And, you know, I think, you know, 79... You know, there was the Jim Jones massacre. There was the you know, various Rajneesh fleeing from the, you know, I don't know. There was lots of stuff going on, I think, from his Indian tax bill. And he went to America, I think, then or something. But the cracks started to appear. The clay feet of the gurus started to appear towards the end of the 70s. Then you had the sort of human potential movement. And this is all a maturing in a way, I see, at a collective level. So you say, okay, well, you know, the gurus could give you quite a lot, but you really need to develop it inside. Let's, you know, let's sit around in circles and do, you know, the kind of work that, you know, we're all familiar with, you know, in terms of group work here.
I just want to say I was part of the human potential movement in the mid-70s in California, and it was so exciting. Yeah. You know, we all felt that we were visionaries. We all felt, you know, that we'd come to create a new world.
Yeah.
And all sort of yuppiedom sort of hadn't yet taken over California. It was the most exciting time. And all the great teachers, Fritjof Capra, Ida Rolf,
Fritz Perls,
Moshe Feldenkrais, Fritz Perls, all of these geniuses, they couldn't do their work in the European countries. They had to come to California.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah. You were right at the beginning of that.
It was so exciting, yeah.
That's really exciting like that. Now, I don't know whether, I mean, there was certainly an undercurrent of the guru thing, if we're using this surfing analogy, you know, with people getting, you know, the whole cult problem and the abuse problem that you were talking about in the last week's episode. You got that when the guru phenomenon sort of waned slightly. And then the human potential one, I don't know if there was a downside to that, but the perhaps there wasn't. But I think that, and it's still going on, of course, but the shift then that I detected as you go into the 90s now, so that's the 80s, as you go into the 90s, you've got essentially the growing awareness of the environmental crisis. You had the first, you know, the big fire in Yosemite in whenever it was, 88 or 90 or something. And people, the way I see the 90s very generally is that people's sense of the sort of spiritual purpose and meaning and all that, they started to include more than just themselves. Up until this moment, you're just working on yourself. You know, you're having psychedelic experiences in the 60s on your individual consciousness. Then you're having the guru experience, and then you're having humanistic psychology, which is much more human, more embodied, and so on. And then you've got, oh gosh, the planet's under stress, and the rise of an interest in indigenous cultures in Native America. That's when you start to see the Native American teachers coming and
shamanism,
exactly. Shamanism, people, you know. So I think we've been through a sort of cyclotron of collective experiences, and some of us have sort of surfed all of those waves. Some of us perhaps have just surfed one or two, but I think that, you know, the very interesting question is where are we now? You know, so then we go into the new millennium.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so clear to me what's happening. Well, I think what happened with the dawning of the new millennium was, of course, the awful business of 9/11, which propelled us into an extremely dark and difficult period that we're still in. I remember around time, I don't know whether you remember this, but there were some people saying, oh, you know, it was just a blip. You know, we'll get over it. 9/11, you know, this awful business. And I remember being so struck by it. I remember at one stage being so overwhelmed. I was driving on the A27 from Brighton, and I remember having to pull into a lay-by because I was so overwhelmed with this kind of collective grief. And this voice just said in my head, you know, if you don't understand that things have fundamentally changed because of this, then you don't have a proper grasp of reality. And you know, this is very, you know, very significant, which I think it was. I mean, if you think about it, it precipitated a sort of sequence of events that ended up with the Iraq war and, you know, huge amounts of suffering and increased international tensions and difficulties, which has simply kind of billowed on, hasn't it? We are today, which is why I think, you know, your the concept in your podcast is absolutely fantastic. And in fact, when Steve was introducing it, I took the transcript, Steve, where you talk about how there's this myth that spiritual people aren't interested in everyday events and say, don't worry, everything's perfect, and you know, but actually your experience is that when you as you awaken spiritually, as you start to work with this, you become more concerned about the fate of the world, not less.
Definitely.
Anyway, so that's
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some positive trends. Hmm. I think that the 60s was a really important point, in the collective evolution of consciousness. I think it was a kind of opening and expansion of consciousness.
Hmm.
And it seemed to sort of recede a little bit in the 1970s, maybe as the shadow emerged.
Yep.
But I think that expansion has continued. I think there has been a collective expansion of consciousness. I mean, I became interested in spirituality around about 1990, hmm. when I was about maybe 23 years old.
Hmm.
And it was very difficult to find out information about spirituality in my environment. You know, it took me a long time to understand what was going on in myself.
Hmm.
But now, you know, it seems to be everywhere, maybe because of the internet. It's very easy to find out about spiritual traditions and practices and concepts, much easier than it was. And there seems to be a kind of a gradual opening. More and more people are gravitating towards spiritual practices and paths. I see it with my own kids. My kids, my son's 20. He meditates. His friends meditate.
Great.
And they're just normal guys. They're not, you know, spiritual guys. They're normal kind of sporty university students.
Well, yeah. They're lucky to have you as their father, Steve.
They're supposed to rebel against me, but...
Well, I think you're right. I don't know what you think, Serge, but I think on the one hand, you've got this track. If you follow the sort of track of world events, you know, which has been so gloomy since 9/11 and onwards into through the first 26 years of the 21st century, very gloomy and sad. And yet, exactly as you say, Steve, I think there's this another track of extraordinary positive initiatives. There was a guy who wrote the book. He gave a commencement speech for Yale or Harvard or something. Blessed Unrest. I don't know if you remember him.
Paul Hawken from
Paul Finn Hawken. Hall. And his Paul thing, Hawken. Yeah, his thing was the amount of positive initiatives in the world are just stunning. And in the kind of film that they made to go with it, they just scroll up all the initiatives that are taking place around the world, positive initiatives, and there are thousands of them. You know,
fantastic. I'll tell you, that's why I am very positive about the future. I've just written a book about exploring how we can be an agent for regeneration of the future. Mm. And all these positive people, the wonderful thing is that they're operating underneath the radar. Mm. You know, the media don't sort of talk about them. Mm. You know, mm. one won't get a review in the New York Review of Books on spiritual books.
Mm.
Mm. And
well, funnily enough,
also in Russia, I'll just quickly say this, the transpersonal psychology movement is flourishing in Russia.
Is it?
Because it's not seen as dangerous.
Mm. Great. Mm. Wow.
And that's great.
Yes, yes. And then, no, I think you're right. And then what's interesting, the interesting question to ask ourselves is, okay, what can I do? And like you, if I'm right in saying you two have asked yourselves this question, you said, well, let's do this podcast. That's like one thing we can do to help spread these ideas and be some kind of catalyst for change.
Yeah, I think there was a kind of widening. I sometimes talk about the circle of concern. Some people are only really concerned for themselves or maybe their families or maybe their community. But I think the circle of concern is kind of widening that more and more people are being concerned with world events, you know, with the climate crisis, political events. So I think people are becoming less narcissistic. Some people, anyway, are becoming less narcissistic and are opening their compassion in a more expansive way.
And world events are having two effects. It's closing some people down. I can't deal with this. It's too big.
Yeah,
But the fierceness of the grace of world events is that it's helping open a lot of people up. And so that's important.
That's really important.
We are in this fierce world of crisis in every area. And as William Ophel said, you know, civilization is decline. You know, that there's a time for civilizations to move up and there's a time for them to fall down. And now it's falling down. And our responsibility, sort of people like us, is to help people who are doing the falling down and help them realize that it's the end of one era, but the beginning of a new one.
Yeah. Exactly. And something that you, Steve, when you're talking about the circle of concern, what's really interesting is I think you've got this concept of the circle of concern, and then helping oneself and other people to understand that one's circle of influence is different. You draw your circle of concern. I think you're right. More and more people will say, well, I'm concerned about the whole world. I'm concerned about all the animals, that, you know, that the earth herself and so on. Big circle of concern. And then it's really helpful to say, okay, what's your circle of influence? And you draw it on top. And of course, it's smaller. And that immediately just kind of, when you get it, that can relieve that kind of pressure of overwhelm, of thinking, well, you know, what can I do? I'm too small. You read it. Okay, my circle of influence is smaller. And then you have, then you can draw another circle, the circle of control, which is smaller again. Mm-hmm. And helping people to kind of clarify that can be really useful. And then, and then the question comes, what can I do, given that my circle of influence is here? What can I do within that? And what can I control within that, and to be of value in the world? And then you come to Serge's idea about the collapse of old structures. And there's this marvelous process called, I don't know if you've heard of it, called super blooming. Have you heard of this?
No.
Super blooming. Well, I have a friend, Dr. Rosalind Watts, who gives a fantastic presentation on this. And super blooming is basically the phenomenon that occurs after a wildfire. So there's all devastation, and there's horrible images of charred trees and blackened landscape. But then you get all these incredible flowers that come out and various growth processes that are stimulated. So you get what's called the super blooming, which is a wonderful kind of metaphor and biological sort of parallel. But the process that, you know, we hope we can help with is that as the structures collapse, perhaps this is making a bit of room for, you know, positive initiatives and new initiatives.
Well, it's Priogene's theory as well, that when the old collapses, it draws new. When the system collapses, or when a corporation collapses, it draws new creativity out of the system that was not available before.
Yeah. It happens to us as individuals all the time. Whenever we go through crises in our lives, when we're seriously ill, or relationships break down, or we have a bereavement, we put ourselves back together, and we arise at a higher level of order. You know, we become more integrated, we become deeper and stronger. And this is what in psychology it's called post-traumatic growth.
And the stats on post-traumatic growth are rather interesting, aren't they? Because it's not a rare phenomenon.
No, it's like 47% of people experience it, which is amazing.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
And I think maybe our whole species is collectively undergoing a post-traumatic growth.
You know? That's a really interesting idea, isn't it, to express it in that way. What if humanity is challenged with trauma, you know? And we can go through some sort of post, you know, we can encourage a process of post-traumatic growth.
Yeah. Yeah. You could even compare it to people who are diagnosed with cancer. They often, sometimes have a spiritual awakening.
Yeah.
You know, the whole perspective on life changes. They become more grateful. Their relationships become deeper and stronger.
Well, how can we encourage? Sorry, Serge.
No, I was just going to say that Chris Bash, in his book, LSD and the Mind of God, you know, suggests that out of suffering, a whole new brand of compassionate humanity is going to be emerging.
Yeah. Right. So out of the suffering
out of the suffering.
And is there a way that, I mean, in looking at the process of post-traumatic growth amongst individuals, is there a way, have they been able to identify factors that would help get a positive outcome and get post-traumatic growth?
Yeah, it partly depends on your personality type. If you have an open and curious personality, you know, rather than a controlling personality, then you're more open to new experiences, so you accept the growth. But also, maybe the most important factor is acknowledgement and acceptance. So you acknowledge your predicament. You know, you acknowledge the fact that you are ill, or you've had a bereavement, or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And that's when the growth occurs, through the acknowledgement and acceptance. So if you kind of resist your predicament, but you don't want to face it, you don't want to accept it, then you will not undergo growth.
And that's what you see on the, is it fair to draw the sort of in the political sphere, you know, the extraordinary way that politicians can sometimes be in denial of whatever it is, you know, the immense suffering that's occurring, or the, you know, the poverty, the inequality, just not really facing the facts, not facing the reality of the kind of situation they're dealing with.
And we don't only see it with the fascist politicians, but with the so-called democratic ones as well. I mean, I think that the old school of politics is going to experience a severe collapse, and I think a whole new breed of transpersonally oriented politicians is going to arrive.
That would be wonderful, but how are we going to get elected?
What I am interested in is the new course that that you're going to start teaching in December about spiritual psychology, and Steve's going to be helping you on it. Mm. And that is really a course to prepare human beings for a new dimension of their humanity. It's very, very interesting what you're doing. I mean, could you talk a little bit about the vision behind it?
Sure,
because
yes.
I think it's fantastic.
Well, thank you, Serge. Yes, it's starting at the beginning of December. So I think the two areas of spirituality and psychology, when you bring them together, they're just becoming incredibly fertile region. And of course, you can say that a spiritual perspective in psychology has been there actually really from the beginning of the study, the scientific study of psychology, the historical study, and expressed particularly clearly, you know, with Carl Jung and with Psychosynthesis, Saggioli, a number of other people as well. But the reason why I'm using that as a title is because even with transpersonal psychology, which is the sort of most sort of up-to-date, if you like, incarnation of that interest, just the term transpersonal, I find tends to be doesn't quite fit for me. I think that actually naming the two elements of this perspective is the most helpful way to do it, and really it's a question, I think, of looking at the goals we have as human beings, which are precisely the goals that you guys have kind of homed in on, is of not just seeking our own enlightenment and well-being, but actually wanting to be of wider use in the world, to be
of service,
to be of service. I think that, you know, and that's the, you know, and so that's at the end of the course. We really look at that in some detail of saying, you know, what is this impulse? You know, what do we feel drawn to do? What are the things that get in the way of that? How can we encourage that aspect of ourselves? Looking at all those things, and so it's freedom for what is the, you know, we're seeking freedom in studying these things and following this way, but freedom for what? And it's that, you see. So that's the sort of end point. And then the module before that, I'm kind of describing the curriculum backwards, as it were, but the module before that is the matrix. It's like, what's preventing us from being free? You know, what all the factors, you know, and, you know, let's look at the whole range, you know, like, you know, what's karma? Is that kind of preventing us? What the influence of past lives, you know, the genetic influences, psychodynamic influences,
spirit attachments.
Yeah, looking at that, exactly, that really tricky area of sort of entities and attachments. Yeah. All these things, you know, what's keeping us in the matrix? And thinking of your broadcast, your previous episode where you looked at gurus and spiritual cults, it's really interesting to look at that, not only as a potential means of liberation, but also potential means of enslavement in some way. I mean, there's lots of stuff to look at, like what's holding us in these patterns. So there's a whole bunch of sort of stuff we do on that. And then prior to that, there's the sort of the you know, who are we talking about here, i.e. what is the human being?
Well, let's look at what holds us in these patterns, because this is the really key thing which we're all exploring, Philip. What holds us?
What holds us in these patterns?
What holds us? Our addiction or attachment to ordinary reality, our addiction or attachment to the stories that we inherited about that we're all separate from each other. What holds us to the attachment of our materiality and the belief that who we are is our ideas about ourselves? What holds us to this?
Yes, exactly. And in a way, looking at gurus and cults is actually a very useful kind of way of delimiting the field, so that we can try to understand some of the dynamics that actually are happening in the wider world and in our wider lives. But they provide us with a frame, which is why those films, you know, there's a whole genre of films now. One of the things we're going to do in the course is recommend a course of sort of film, psychoeducation through films, starting with the sort of famous ones, Wild Wild Country and Kumari. And there's a whole slew now, you know, a dozen really interesting documentaries that... interesting, and we can look at that. But you know, and if we home in on that, and in a way also carrying on from your conversation last week, I mean, and this is an interesting example of where psychology as a study can really illuminate these processes in a way that spiritual teachings can't, which is why I think we need the two, you see. I think we really need spiritual teachings, because they open us to the mystery, and there are all sorts of interesting kind of technologies in spiritual teachings. But psychology comes with a particular kind of set of tools and skills and perspectives that are really helpful.
Yeah.
So sorry, Steve.
Sorry, Philip. I was just going to say, I think a lot of people are attracted to gurus, not for spiritual reasons, but for psychological reasons, you know. A desire to abdicate responsibility, a desire for a powerful father figure to take control of their lives.
And if they're very wounded, Steve,
to worship somebody,
to Mr. Trump, because he's a cult leader.
Yeah, there are so many similarities between authoritarian political leaders and gurus and leaders. It's the same syndrome. It's the desire for a powerful father figure.
Not wanting to take responsibility for our own lives.
Yeah, it's like being if you can remember being a seven-year-old child and you think that your parents are perfect, you think that your parents are in control and will sort out everything. I remember being shocked when I was about 11 and I realised that my father wasn't perfect.
Yes, there was
It's a bit like that, you know, they're regressing to being small children and to putting their faith in powerful parental figures.
Exactly. So that whole business of, you know, projection and transference that psychology is so good at explaining, that you've explained, that's obviously a huge dynamic at work. But then you've also got the conformity effect, which has been studied quite widely as well, which is going on. Confirmation bias. You know, you pointed out, Steve, last week how when the guru does something that from a commonsensical point of view is so outrageous or irrational, people within the group will rationalize it. Oh, they'll say he's just testing your faith by saying such an irrational thing, he's not an alcoholic, he's just showing us that alcohol has no effect on his system, so he drinks rather a lot of it, you know, or whatever. So you've got all that confirmation bias, and then you've got the halo effect, which has been studied since the 1920s. I mean, lots of research on that, which is basically, you know, which we see in the everyday world. You know, if so-and-so is a good footballer, he must be a fantastic chef, singer, lover. So if the guru's particularly good at delivering a fantastically sort of illuminating talk, as you were talking about, Serge, weren't you? You know, how they're good in a particular field. They're particularly good at expressing ideas around the spiritual life. And then the halo effect comes into play and think, well, this guy is wonderful in every possible way. Because actually he might be disastrous in his personal relationships. You know?
Yeah. And there's a certain archetype as well, isn't there? You know, the guru with the flowing white beard and the robe. And I think if you consciously follow that archetype, yeah, it is quite easy to attract followers, you know.
Well, that's
your
why the
beard,
film...
Your beard, Philip, is not long enough.
It's not long enough, I know.
And intentionally so, because very important, you represent, and it's really important, this point, you're not a guru. You're the next stage. You're an enhancer of others, as opposed to you telling them how it is. You are the enhancer. I will stand behind you and give you a space so you can develop who you are. And I think that this is the next level. I think that the age of the spiritual master sort of is coming to an end.
I think,
Philip, that you represent the next stage. I think.
Well, I'll tell you what thoughts that occur to me when you say that, Serge, is I've never felt myself to be a guru or even a teacher, although now, you know, because I've taught so much and I'm teaching various courses, I've sort of started to use that word just to accepting the fact that that's what I do. I do quite a lot of teaching. But for years, I resisted that up until kind of last year or 2 years ago or something, because I've always felt as if I'm just having conversations with people. You know, we're just doing, you know, what we're doing now, just exploring and sharing interesting ideas and sort of insights and thoughts that one has. So, you know, whenever I do Tea with the Druid on Mondays, you know, I do this kind of weekly thing, a YouTube thing, and I just chat. I'm just literally having a conversation with people, just sharing ideas and
do you wear a nice pointy hat for your teas? Don't druids have nice pointy hats? Nice,
no, they don't, Serge.
Sort of Ku Klux Klan-y sort of white hats.
No. They used to wear. I kind of refuse to wear it except when it's raining and I in a ceremony or something. But they're called wimples. Actually, I don't wear a wimple. Actually, wimples are the ones which are based on the sort of Egyptian, you know, they're a bit of elastic around the head, the white thing, and then it goes back like a nurse or a nun.
So do you still think of yourself as a druid, Philip?
From the day I began following druidry or being you know, I'm resisting the word thing, saying being a druid, following druid, I've always resisted calling myself a druid. I think it's because I don't like labels.
Yeah.
I feel restricted, you know. It's like, you know, when you're asked to describe yourself, you say, well, Philip's a psychologist. Well, yes, but, you know, what does that mean? And there's more. It's not the only, you know, he's a writer. Yes, well, yes, I do write books, but that's not my sole identity, you know.
Yeah.
The teacher, well, yes, I do teach things, but I'm not, you know. And the druid is I mean, I quite like the way the etymology of it boils down to a forest sage, sort of.
Oh, right.
You know, that's quite, you know, Drew has sort of origins in, you know, the oak tree, and which you can extrapolate to the forest, the trees, tree wisdom, somebody who's tree, you know. So it's a nice word, but I tend to try to avoid using it.
And he's more, but Philip. The druid is more than a sub-personality. He's a deeper part of you. He's sort of etched into your essence somehow. But, or can't one say that sort of druidry is just a name that's given to a certain kind of sort of nature, sort of wisdom, sort of mysticism, and it happens to have that name, but you feel and have always been connected to that?
Yes, I think I spent most of the 32 years that I was the chief druid of the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids, I spent most of those 32 years trying to think of how I could get rid of the term chief. And again, I tried to avoid using it as much as possible. I'd say my favorite way of saying was that he helps to lead, because it was always a team effort. You know, Philip helps to lead the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids. Yeah. And then I also spent most of those 32 years trying to get rid of the term druid. But sounds crazy, but I mean, it's true. I mean, I spent an inordinate amount of effort talking with my partner, Stephanie, and having discussions with friends and team members and all that. You know, but we always came back to the position that, well, if you call it nature spirituality, the nature way, or, you know, we could never come up with a term that felt right. And in the end, again, just in the last few years, I've come to realize that the thing about the uniqueness of Druidry is that it has a real emphasis on the arts. There's the whole bardic tradition, the Eisteddfod, festivals of art, storytelling, music, which is embedded in the culture of these islands and this part of the world. And in fact, it's found in the cultures of all, you know, all indigenous spiritualities have tremendous storytelling and sort of music. So it exists there, but it's the way that the arts and an appreciation of nature and a kind of desire to be at one are brought together within Druidry.
So therefore, it's very important, Philip, that you hold the essence of Druidry in terms of your work as a synthesizer today, because it holds a very rich spiritual tradition that needs to continue, but to express itself in new forms.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, I guess, yeah.
But I can relate to that. I think it's admirable that you kind of resist these labels. I think some people need labels to kind of reinforce their egos, to give them a sense of identity. And also, once you establish yourself as a guru or teacher, you create a hierarchy. You separate yourself from other people. I've never been comfortable with that hierarchy or that separation from other people.
Absolutely. And yet you need leaders. That's the thing. That was the sort of conundrum that on the one hand, because we've experimented. It's interesting, these tensions you have. You know, for instance, if you take, you know, we've experimented with different forms of leadership. We had, for 20 years, we ran, I mean, we still do, but we've kind of hived it off and other people do it. But the order itself ran camps, four camps a year. And we used it as a kind of experimental field for trying different models of leadership and organization. And it was quite fascinating because over those 20 years, basically what would happen is there'd be a particular structure and then it would kind of implode and appear to be destroyed. And they'd be always quite dramatic, but then it would reform. So in other words, to give you an example, I'm trying to remember which way round it went, the sequence, but we basically had a structure where we had what was called circle. And a flat, there was no hierarchy. There were just a group of people who were responsible for putting the event on and running it. Everybody equal, which resulted in endless meetings, sharing meetings, because there was no such thing as a quorum or a casting vote or somebody in charge. And I used to sit with my hands, sit on my hands, you know, when there'd be a discussion that would go round and round about whether to buy a fridge for the camp, you know, and I'd want to blurt, oh, just buy the effing fridge for God's sake, you know, but I'd absolutely resist it. And so it took forever. And it was so democratic or so open. Everybody paid by what was called the magic hat. So everybody would arrive at the campsite and we'd have a wizard's hat that Serge was talking about, and it would get passed around and people would make a... So it always lost money. So it was a complete disaster. So after it, we would say it was subsidized for about 4 years. And in the end, you know, it was just totally untenable. So we moved to the stage of a sort of dictatorship. We put one very strong woman, very capable, very talented woman in charge, who sort of ruled with an iron fist. And the result was it got organized really fast. We started, you know, able to buy structures and all the rest of it. But after, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, it became too rigid. Yeah. And sort of rebellion, you know. And so in some awful meeting one day when people started protesting and people started crying and camp two and different pro and con, you know, emerged and it all exploded. And so we went on and we went through about three incarnations, you know.
Yeah. I guess democracy is very time consuming, isn't it? You know, to have a leader, they can make quick decisions. But the danger is you often end up with bad leaders. The people who elect themselves to be leaders are often the worst people, aren't they?
Well, that's right. I think that's what you see with the rise of populism and the right wing. It's like, oh, God, it's such a mess. You know, people, every prime minister, every government talks about fixing the NHS.
Yeah.
You know, but they can't do it. Let's just get some bossy boot person in who just seems to be absolutely sure, you know, and we know what happens. It'll just be even more chaotic.
And these people are often psychopaths or sometimes psychopaths and narcissists. They have no empathy. They project decisiveness, but they actually lack inhibitions or thoughtfulness or consideration, responsibility.
And there's huge shallowness.
A huge shallowness. And I remember you, Steve, you presented a paper or you wrote a piece about, if I've got it right, you were essentially saying this and saying, really, politicians need to go through some psychometric tests because these sorts of people's shouldn't be in positions of power.
No, exactly.
You know,
it's the dysfunctionality of the system that somehow it brings the wrong kind of people in power so that the dysfunctionality can continue to propagate itself.
Yeah, I mean, often people who are wise and altruistic are not really interested in being a politician, but people who crave for power and wealth, they are interested in being politicians. So they put themselves forward as electoral representatives. And, you know,
did you ever get any mileage with that? Because when I read your article, I thought, you know, the British Psychological Society should propose this as a serious proposition
to the political
establishment.
Yeah, I thought so too. And I tried to start a petition or a movement within psychology or within that society. But didn't really get anywhere. Strangely enough, a lot of psychologists were opposed to it.
Really?
Yeah, they thought, you know, who are psychologists to decide this? You know, you'll end up with a kind of dictatorship of psychologists to hold
power. They can control the levers of power.
I know, but it was strange. I don't know why people were not in favor of it, but, you know, it was strange.
Well, I mean, one of the things that happened when Trump came in his first term, I was giving a talk in Reykjavik in Iceland, and I met a psychoanalyst who's also a Druid, who's a member of our group, and he happened to be in Iceland as well. And we had this fascinating discussion that evening that he was part of a group of thousands of psychologists who were opposed to Trump. They had, you know, somebody had written a book about, a psychiatrist had written a book sort of galvanizing the world of mental health professionals. And they were having a conference, a kind of online conference with thousands of people involved saying, hey, look, the guy's not well. He needs to be restrained in some way. Of course, it got nowhere. But I still think that idea is worth pursuing.
I do, yeah. I'm sure it will gain traction eventually. I think more and more people are realizing that it is an issue. You know, you can't really trust the people who put themselves forward for positions of power. And I'd like a return to the original Greek idea of democracy, which was all about participation.
Mm.
And which didn't really invest power in individuals. You know, that there would be groups of people who would make decisions. There would be boards of people who would, you know, administer certain aspects of society. But they knew that there was a problem with, if you invest power in individuals, you will attract the wrong type of individuals.
And I think the concept of citizens' assemblies, which I think they've tried in France, and I think possibly they've tried them in England, I'm not sure, but I know that in France they did that. That's a kind of interesting development, I think.
That's a return to the original principle of democracy.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure in the next 74 years, we're going to have many experiments of different kinds of leadership, and different kinds of ways of doing it. It seems at the moment that somehow the darkest shadow of our world, or everything that humanity as a whole has not faced, like the patriarchal shadow, is coming up. Remember that poem, thank God this time is now, when wrong comes up to face us, never to leave us until, never to leave us until something, this is a journey unto soul, i.e. comparing the shadow of the world with the emergence of soul.
I think it was a Christopher Fry poem.
It was a Christopher Fry.
Mm. Yes, yes.
And George Trevelyan would always be.
He was always it. Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. Yeah,
and it was his favorite poem. Yeah. So, sort of, a lot of wrong is coming up to face us now.
Mm. Yeah, and
somehow.
I think there is a rising tide of wakefulness, you know, which we discussed earlier, and I think there is a reaction to that, you know,
exactly.
The ego, the patriarchal ego, you know, capitalism, the kind of anti-natural forces are rising up in defense. They feel threatened, so they're trying to become stronger in reaction to the rising tide of wakefulness.
Wakefulness, yes, yes.
And the manosphere is being very much threatened by the return of the goddess, by the emergence of the feminine principle, by a coming back.
Anne Baring has just written
a wonderful book about the goddess, and I think it's so important that we realize that goddess energy is coming back.
Yes.
And I think in the next 50 years we're going to see really evolved women coming into positions of power.
I think all
over the world.
I think the feminine is rising, isn't it?
But we're seeing that more and more. I mean, just scrolling through your Instagram, looking at YouTube, reading widely, that's definitely coming to the fore.
Yeah. And maybe what I notice is that I go to the Lake District quite a lot and go wild swimming, cold swimming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's always women. It's very rare that you find a man doing it. There are loads of women, walking as well. Lots of women, female walkers.
It's like these courses that I do, you know, it's usually... at least two thirds women, they're kind of more switched on, I think.
I definitely.
And I wonder if whether this tribute, I should have mentioned it before, but I have another meeting on the hour, which is in 3 minutes.
Oh, sorry.
So maybe that's a good, it feels
a good
like
place
a good place, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you just ask Philip one of,
we want to end the podcast with a series of quick fire questions, Philip.
Okay.
Very quick fire.
Yeah.
What is the most influential book that you've read?
You can edit. You have to edit this long pause out. What comes to me at the The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. Had a really profound influence on me. I mean, there are a number of them, but let's say The Denial of Death, Ernest Becker.
Right. Yeah. What about your most influential teacher or mentor?
My most influential was my Druid mentor. I thought it was my guru, who had a lot of charisma, but in the end, I realized that it was my Druid teacher who wasn't charismatic and was very ordinary and down to earth.
Brilliant.
He had the more lasting influence on me.
Beautiful, beautiful. How about the most powerful spiritual place you visited?
Ooh. Iona in Scotland has the most extraordinary, the Isle of the Druids, as it used to be known, has the most incredibly powerful energy there. Yeah.
And final question, the most inspiring or spiritual piece of music that you can remember?
There's such a lot. I mean, I love Bach's Mass in B minor. That lifts me up. I'm finding great spiritual sort of upliftment now in Max Richter's work. You know, the version of that was produced for Hamnet, the film Hamnet, on the nature of daylight. There are two versions, and the film version of it on the nature of daylight is so heart-opening. I'm sort of more interested in, rather than being uplifted in that kind of transcendent way, which I spend a lot of my youth seeking, I'm more interested in sort of heart-opening, direction. And that particular track on the nature of daylight from the film Hamnet, I find exquisite.
Wow. Wow. I'll have a listen to that.
Great.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Philip. Philip, a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Philip. Lovely.
Okay. See you then. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.